there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 403. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter. The handle is thisshowisogay. And of course, go on over to that Facebook. Type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have a jam-packed episode for you all this week with some amazing guests. Let me introduce the first one to you right this very second. Sam Pancake is an award-winning actor, writer, producer, comedian, and so much more. You know him from his spots on Gilmore Girls, The Mick, Transparent, Legally Blonde 2, Arrested Development, Curb Your Enthusiasm, and many, many more. He was nominated for a couple of Indie Series Awards and won a Hollyweb Festival Award for his work in Pretty the Series. He's also an incredible podcaster, and if you have not listened to The Gasp, which we are going to talk all about, you are truly missing out. Right this second, though, he is here with us. Sam, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
Hi, Ken. Thank you for having me.
We have so much ground to cover, Sam. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'm going to put on my seatbelt and get ready and go on the roller coaster.
Well, let's go back in time on our roller coaster. When little Sam Pancake was running around West Virginia, was this the dream?
This was always the dream, I have to say. I got the bug pretty early in rural West Virginia in the 1960s and 70s, which was strange because no one else in my family was remotely connected to show business or performing or anything. My mother was an artist and my dad was a minister, so those are not too far away from the world of, you know, creative performing in some ways. But I always wanted to be an actor, and I knew that maybe that would be weird and hard because I knew I was gay really early, and back then who knew what that would mean or
right.
What that would look like years later. Thank God it's looking pretty good in the last 20 years or so.
Yeah.
Or so much better. But I was either that or artist or architect. Everything started with an A, and I just couldn't do I wasn't talented enough as an artist, and I was not good with math to be an architect. So I was kind of like, yay, then I have to be an actor.
Process of elimination, and there's your career.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Was there that one pivotal moment where you said, this is it. I am having just such a great experience. This is what I want to be doing.
I think it was slowly in college, probably, because I did, in high school, I did a couple of really fun, sort of one of those bad written for high school theater plays, which weren't, you know, that was all right experience, done in the high school gym. But I think it was in college, probably, when I got over the anxiety and nerves of the first couple of years of, you know, beginning acting class and,
right.
And, you know, movement and mask work and all that stuff. And when I finally got to do in the conservatory program they had where I went to school, my career didn't go this way, and it's fine. But when we first started doing the Seagull and playing Don Arcade and his son, Nikolai, I think, or playing, I remember doing Richard III in class and just being so grateful to be able to do my take on those amazing words.
Yeah.
And just feeling for the first time the magic kind of happening within me. I have no idea if I was good or bad, but the feeling I had about it just made me say, I want this. I crave more of this. And then later on, and when I started doing TV and film work, and improv stuff, that was it's just so much fun. I still just love going to sets and being a part of this crazy world. It still feels like a wacky circus movable feast.
Let's do a little Sam Pancake, This Is Your IMDb Life, and hit some highlights. I love it. It's so much fun. We always have to start with the first credit because I love starting with the first credit. What do you remember about being the delivery man in Wings?
I remember that I had auditioned. I got it from doing a casting director workshop, which is one of these things. And I think they still have them. This is exactly the same thing where you go to a workshop for 6 weeks and meet different casting directors. And I had only been in LA just over 2 years and was lucky enough to have had my SAG card already. And I'll never forget Sheila Guthrie was the casting person, and also Jeff Greenberg, who does Modern Family now. It was Sheila and him, and they brought me in for this class, and I read the little line, and I got it, and it was at the Paramount lot, which was, you know, is iconic then, iconic now.
Yeah.
And we went directly from the casting room to the set of Wings, And I remember thinking, I know that Laverne and Shirley was shot near here. It might have even been the same set, the same stage. And I remember that Steven Weber, who I am still friendly with, like, who he was so nice to me. And I still see him around. We have friends in common, and we run into each other sometimes. So that was really neat. So I remember, and I also remember being on a soundstage for the first time, not counting like Universal Studio Tours, but working on a soundstage the first time on that. Wow. And there was an earthquake.
Oh my gosh.
And I remember the plane that was there in the quote unquote airport just like swaying back and forth and everyone running outside. So my first earthquake, or one of my first, the first memorable earthquake to me, I was actually on set, which was kind of neat.
Do you understand, though, for the rest of us, can you not say quote-unquote airport? Because some of us believe that it really was, Sam.
Sorry. That airport they have, that landing strip they have right on the Paramount lot. I mean, in New Hampshire, wherever that was supposed to be.
I would like to believe that that was just a documentary where people had funny lives.
Sure.
Great.
Exactly,
I feel
yeah.
good about that.
Sure.
Some more street cred for Sam Pancake. How about appearing with Cagney and Lacey? That's very exciting.
Yeah. It was Cagney and Lacey, the reunion. And I remember playing this, it was one of my first, like, an early gay role, and it was kind of written sort of like, I remember the character actually said, I'm a homosexual, Mrs. Lacey, like, just so everyone got it. But, and it was obviously a murder mystery thing, but they were both so nice to me. Sharon and Tyne were absolutely lovely, and I only did it for a day or two, but they were really nice.
Now, that's gay street cred, but let me give you some nerd street cred, which is big
sure.
in my hood. Appearing on Angel, that's big.
Yeah, it was great. I wanted nothing more than to be on Buffy. Buffy was my show. It was my jam. All my friends, like my friends, were on Buffy. Jack Plotnick, Tom Link, Kelly Rocha, all got like guest stars or recurrings on that. And it was just like the one show I wanted to be on back then. But instead, I got to be on Charmed and Angel. And I remember like I did the pilot of Angel, and I was a co-star. I'm like working a coffee shop or something, a very small part. But I remember going in and auditioning for Joss Whedon. And at the time, not saying to him, you know, I really want to be on, how can we work this out? Can I also, in this universe, can this guy also be on Buffy somehow? And I remember after we shot it, he was like, well, you didn't die, so, you know, maybe you'll come back. But they say that on every show in which you don't die. But I never came back. But it was good to have it. And also, shows like Angel and Wings, I still get little checks in the mail, so people are still watching them.
Well, let me do one more. And this, I have to tell you, look, my favorite show of all time is The West Wing. I know your part so well. On the West Wing. It was a really important piece of that story.
It was, yeah. And thank God I knew Allison and Matthew before, because it was very intimidating. And also, thank God, I got to read my part, because it was a lot. And you can't do one word, one syllable, one letter wrong with a Sorkin script. And he's always there. Well, this will blow your mind, sir. I actually, before that, like a year before, did this whole scene in an entire episode in a storyline that got completely cut.
No.
I have no idea what happened, but I shot this scene with, get ready, get gay
I
ready,
can't, I
Dr.
Can't.
Channing, Allison Janney, Elizabeth Moss, and Mary Louise Parker.
No.
And then the hot British boy who played Elizabeth Moss's boyfriend at the time. It was all at the Ritz-Carlton in Marina Del Rey. They were on vacation somewhere. I don't remember this. Again, I don't remember the overarching season plot, so I don't remember why they were there, but this whole thing got cut. And we were by the pool, and I had to serve a tray of drinks and spill them all over Allison Janney and Mary Louise Parker and Elizabeth Moss. And so that was an amazing day. And I'll never forget where I was, Soccer Channing was across the pool, and Aaron Sorkin was directing me, and we were standing up about, like, I don't know, 20 feet from each other, Stockard and I. And he was like, my direction was, he's like, okay, you're a gay guy, and like, you seeing, you know, Abigail Bartlett and the daughter is like a gay guy seeing Judy Garland and Liza Minnelli. Oh, no, he didn't say I was gay. He's like, it's like seeing a gay guy seeing Judy Garland and Liza Minnelli. And I said, Mr. Sorkin, Stockard Channing makes me excited enough. I don't have to pretend. And she heard me, and she walked this, like, wonderful lady-like actress stride across the pool, and she took my hand, and she said, thank you.
Sam, I love this story so much. I don't really know what to do.
It's really, and I don't even know what happened to that whole thing. And then luckily, like a year later, I got to play Stu Winkle, which I only know because it's there on my IMDb, and I was like, and they just offered it to me, and I'm like, did they think of Sam Pancake Stu Winkle? That's not too far off, but whoever it was, I was just glad to do it.
Well, any West Wing aficionado, this is not a bit part. You actually helped take down the vice presidency. This is a big deal.
Why?
Are you kidding?
I have no memory of anything I said.
Oh my gosh, no. I'm going to get scary here.
Stu Winkle was right now in Washington, right? Helping take some people down.
He really did. Stu Winkle got the scoop, and the vice president then had to step down. It set a lot of things in motion. So Stu Winkle, a very big part.
Oh my.
Who knew?
That's great.
I love it. Give me one more. So that's three or four that I chose. What's one that you walked away saying, holy cow, I can't believe I did that?
Oh, man, this sounds so trite and corny, but it's true. I've been so lucky. Well, recently, and I've said this a few times, getting to work with B. Carol King on Gilmore Girls and how our final days, we both wrapped on the same day. And she gave us a little mini concert, which also happened to be Lauren Graham's birthday. And it was just an amazing time. Carol played You've Got a Friend, and I Feel the Earth Move for us, just for the actors and the crew. No cell phones allowed. She's like, let's just make this for us. And it was weeping. And then also on that, getting to watch Christian Borle and Sutton Foster perform for us for 2 days on end doing the musical. And that was really magical. But reaching further back, well, this is a cool thing. And I was being interviewed yesterday by someone, and I remembered that back when I first moved here, I worked at Johnny Rockets.
Yeah.
The second Johnny Rockets ever in Westwood. And I got to wait on my childhood heroes like the Fonz, Henry Winkler.
Of course.
Jacqueline Smith and John Ritter, and I remember just Patty Duke, all kinds of people. And then later on, John Larroquette, who was in on Night Court, and later on I got to work with Henry and play his assistant on Arrested Development, and I got to tell him, I waited on you, and you were so nice, and I made it, more or less, here I am. And he was so cool about it. And then I used to wait all the time on John Larroquette when I worked at Johnny Rockets, and then not till 15, 17 years later, I was on this series, Kitchen Confidential, and John Larroquette was a guest star, and I had to wait on him as an actor. So that was a weird symmetry, too. And I told him, I was like, I used to wait on you, Mr. Johnny Rockets in Westwood in 1988.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. You've spoken quite a bit about playing a number of gay parts. How do you wrap your mind around that? Is that something you love talking about? Is that something where this is just part of my career?
Well, I'm happy to talk about it. I'm really fortunate that they started writing gay parts because I do another one-man show called Wasted on a Boy, which I describe as, I explain the title in the show, which is about me being this out gay actor in Hollywood for 25 years now and how much things have changed. So I can go into deep detail. But overall, it's just interesting how things have gone, how things went through a cycle of when I first got here, late 80s, early 90s, don't be so gay, don't be light in the loafers, you had to butch everything up, especially to do commercials, which I was doing a lot of. And then after Ellen came out and then Will and Grace happened, it was everyone wanted Jack from Will and Grace. They wanted people to be like Sean's character, but Sean's not even like Sean's character.
Right.
And they wanted that for every gay guy to be super like Jack or even more effeminate or more stereotypical, fasten your seatbelts, ladies. These salads will be served in a second. It's really extreme. And then a lot of times I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do me. I'm a gay guy. So whatever I do in this, and I could put some comedic spin. It doesn't have to be a stereotypical spin.
Right.
And sometimes I booked the parts and sometimes I didn't. And then finally, lately, they're back around to more or less gay people. There are all kinds of gay people. Things are a little bit more diverse. It's been true of people of color as well. Finally, we're starting to break some ground with diversity, including not every gay man being a mincing stereotype or, something like that.
Yeah. That's amazing. Again, listeners, we are here with Sam Pancake, actor, writer, producer, comedian, podcaster. How about the gasp? I enjoy the gasp.
Oh, thank you, Ken. Oh, I didn't. Thank you for listening. We love doing it. It's me and my buddy, Gio Andy, and we met a couple of years ago through a program we're both in, which we talk about sometimes on the podcast if you want to listen to it. And then we became really close friends, best friends. He's 26. I'm almost double that. And we kind of started out on a road trip. We're like, oh, we should do a podcast because, there are a lot of podcasts. And I've had ideas before, but leave it to these millennials. They really, get things done.
Don't they?
This one did. So it started out being like, you know, a millennial guy and a Gen X guy, best friends. They happen to be gay and they have a lot of fun together. And then I was like, well, let's, you know, I have all these friends who happen to be celebrities. Let's interview them, you know, that'll get ears. And so it did. And so we just have my friends over, our friends over to my kitchen where I'm standing right now. And we interview them. And it's been really fun. You know, it's weekly. So it's, as you well know, it's more work than I realized, but
right. Yeah.
Luckily with my actor schedule, I'm able to do it, you know, so far so good.
I find the best podcasters are actors or professors because we have so much free time. So we're good.
Oh yeah. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. That's
and
right.
And I love it because there really is, and I hesitate to say this to you, but know that we are of an age together where mm-hmm. there is intergenerational stuff happening where sometimes Gio Andy says things that you're like, yeah, I don't actually know what you're talking about. And I love those moments because I think we've covered this a lot, you know, over the past 9 years of doing this show, that we do have these moments where we don't get together different generations of the gays.
Well, see, my kind of platform, and again, I talk about this in my Wasted on a Boy show, is like when I was a young gay man, sort of not like wildly out of the closet because I wanted to work as an actor and it was a different time, but like everyone knew I was gay and I went in for what tiny little gay roles there were. I didn't have any older gay men to be my mentor.
Right.
Because a lot of men had died. A lot of men were sick. A lot of the actors I knew were deeply in the closet and not there to extend a hand to me. My boss, I worked in casting. It was my commercial casting was my day job, which I fell into that through friends. And I had my boss, Mick Dowd, who was an older gay man, who was a wonderful mentor to me. But other than that, I didn't have any other performer, comedian, actor types 10, 20 years older than me to kind of like, you know, tell me how things were. And of course, it's a different world now. So one thing I really enjoy doing is with my younger friends, to the degree that they're interested, I'm more than happy to help them and give them advice. And I think, you know, some of them will call me about things and including Gio. And so that to be a good big brother type uncle thing without the sexual component,
yeah.
Because of course that's a whole other topic and a whole other conversation. But I mean, one must also have these older men or other, you know, even if it's just slightly older gay men to help be role models and mentors and guides if the person is interested, you know?
Sam, we need to put role model right there on your resume.
Well, I don't know. No, I'm not saying I'm a role model at all. I'm a kind of an anti-role model. Considering some of the things I've done, it's like, one of my things is like, well, I don't do this. Don't end up as, you know, don't end up in rehab if you can help it. But, you know, like I did. But
Sam, we need to put cautionary tale on your resume there.
That's it. Cautionary under special skills.
Well, I just tore through last week. I picked up Lauren Graham's Talking as Fast as I Can. And
yeah.
Any gay guy who reads Talking as Fast as I Can is going to immediately want to be Sam.
That's so great. Thank you. Thank you. She's been a wonderful friend. She's, even though she's younger than me, she's a good mentor to me in terms of like career, you know, business, you know, showbiz advice. She's been fantastic. She's extremely, as you can see from the book, not only is she amazing and funny, and she's just incredibly smart and savvy about stuff.
Yeah, but the rest of us want all about Eve Sam. We were just definitely reading that and thinking there's got to be something we can do here.
Oh, believe me, I'm looking in over my shoulder all the time.
I love it. I love it. So you just recently, last weekend, did your one-man show, Hot, Sweet, and Sticky. You play all of these different parts. How does Sam keep everything straight there, up there on stage?
Oh, God. I don't know, Ken. I'm literally, before the show happens, like up the days leading up to it, I'm just in a blender in my mind of like, you know, sitting down with the three different characters. I mostly relearn it by watching the tapes I have and the notes.
Okay.
But I full confession, I don't have a script for anything. I have all the points I want to hit, and all the characters have specific lines they say. So it's just me organizing that in my mind. And the first woman I do, the first character is a Southern drag queen. The second character I did is whenever I do the show, is a older English actress like Maggie Smith. And the third is a very old, very queeny, bitchy, show busy old, like, I call him Rip Taylor meets Elaine Stritch.
Nice.
Meets, like, you know, I don't know, a schnauzer. He's just a lot. So I just, you know, it's all certainly different parts of me. So I don't know how this is not supposed to sound self-congratulatory at all, but I really don't know how I do it sometimes. And every time I put the shows back up, these are the autobiographical ones. I'm like, how do I do this? I just kind of say, okay, God, you're on, I'm off. Let's dive in. Hope the muses speak to me when they're supposed to. And just, and then I also do like a little, just a little like, not maybe prayer is the right word, to just say, you know, let me just splash joy and laughter on these people. Let me be a way to make people happy right now. And then, you know, that helps me get out of my own way and out of my own insecurities and anxieties.
Yeah, I was going to ask, when you have audiences there, do you feel a different energy there? Like, because you've done film and television, yes. And being on stage is completely different.
Yes. That's the thing about these shows is like, they're so audience determined.
Yeah.
Because in the autobiographical shows, I'm talking directly to the audience. And then in these three characters are also talking to the audience. All three are performances that these people are doing in one way or another. So it's a little bit easier to perform in character because it's not vulnerable Sam right. out there. And I'm also like in wigs and disguises. So that's the thing is like, I can go over and over this stuff in my head, but until I hit the stage in New York or here in LA, I don't know how that alchemy is going to explode. You know, one, because there's so many different lines,
right.
Different lines get different laughs on different nights. You know, it's not necessarily that I'm doing anything wildly differently. It's just is the magic that happens in the room. And I realize now that that kind of makes it more special for people because you can see the show over and over again, and it's never going to be the same show, even though it's quote unquote the same show, you know?
I love it. I love it. Well, we wanted to give you the opportunity to win some This Show Is So Gay swag. And so we wanted to play a little game with you. Someone wrote in and because I put up on social media that you were going to be on the show. And they said, well, obviously you're going to do Gilmore Girls trivia with him. And I said, sure. Yeah, obviously I'm going to do that. So we're going to ask you four questions, Sam. And if you get two of the four right, by the way, I'm feeling confident you're going to do okay with this one. And by the way, if you get any right or none right, you'll also win. So I'm not worried at all about Sam Pancake will win This Show Is So Gay magnet. Some multiple choice questions, two out of four. Here we go. What was, and these were all listener submitted questions. There are some real ardent, there's some ardent Gilmore Girls fans out there.
Honey, tell me about it. I am learning. I knew from Lauren already and all my other friends on the show, but I'm learning firsthand. But they've been really good to me, so I'm grateful for them.
Good stuff. All right. What was Rory's father, Christopher, what was his favorite band? It's multiple choice. It's only two choices. So you got 50-50 with all of these. Was it The Offspring or Wilson Phillips?
I'm going to say Wilson Phillips because that just seems weirder because maybe he did like The Offspring. Was he like a rock and roll? I'm going to say Offspring.
The correct answer is The Offspring. Very good.
Oh, good. Because I know David Sutcliffe. I know him. I mean, does that count?
It totally counts. It counts, and you got the question right. So that should count twice. It doesn't, but it should.
Good.
It should.
Good.
All right.
Because I'm remembering now, he was like a rock and roll guy, right?
Yes.
And back in the day, yeah. He was like, I'm more of a bad boy, and he got Lorelai pregnant.
There you go. There you go. All right, question number two. In the very first scene of the very first episode, what song is playing when Lorelai is walking across the street to Luke's? Was it Kiss Me or There She Goes?
Oh, man, that's a hard one.
I know.
Those songs are so similar.
I know.
There She Goes.
That is the correct answer. I feel like you're going to get all four right, and if you do, we'll give you a magnet to give to Lauren Graham too. So there we go.
If it had been, I will indeed. I'll see her tomorrow. The Kiss Me would have been inappropriate because that would have, you know, foreshadow that she's going to end up with Luke somehow. So they wouldn't have done that.
No, it would be too obvious. All right, question number three. You've already got two right. That's very exciting. What was the name of the game Michelle was playing with Sookie's baby when he accidentally rolled him under the bed? Was it Baby Crepe or Baby Taco?
Baby Crepe. I mean, it's Michel. He's French-Canadian.
That is the correct answer. Very good.
Very good.
And a lot of people would say this is too easy, but for you and I, maybe not. What was the first word ever to be said on the show? Was it please or was it coffee?
Coffee.
Do you know the correct answer was please? I think the second word was coffee. That's okay. Three out of four is good enough, and we will send you a couple. This show is So Gay magnets. Well done. Well done, sir.
Thank you.
You gave a shout out to Gilmore Girls fans. I would imagine in particular, I will just say as a gay man and someone who's seen every single second of Gilmore Girls, it was great to see a gay guy on there.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what Lauren and I were pulling for. because Michelle, of course, he's not really out in the beginning, and he doesn't live in Stars Hollow. And I was always like, why is there no gay in that town? It is the most beautifully art-directed, lit, glorious town. It has to have gay guys in it.
And there you are. Well, what is coming up for you, sir, that you're excited about?
Well, I did three different recurrings on three different pilots this pilot season, which are not on the my IMDb yet, and at least one is not going. Still waiting to hear on the other two, including one with Lauren, a Fox one, which is kind of in limbo right now. Should I say this stuff? It's all on Deadline, so it's fine. I can say
it's all good.
Just waiting to hear what goes on with that stuff in terms of TV. And then stage-wise, after now I don't have anything up for a while. I'm dealing with some family stuff this summer. And then I'm just kind of opening my heart and my mind and my soul for my next job. Hopefully it'll come in soon.
I feel that one-man show is coming up soon, Sam Pancake, in A Cautionary Tale.
And, that's people have said you're going to do the show about rehab and the hospital and all this stuff, my Valley of the Dolls story, which very few know. Maybe that will be next. We'll see.
I'm here to help. I'm here to help.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Listeners, this is what we need you to go do right this very second. Stroll on over to thegasp.podbean.com, and you can listen to all 28 episodes of The Gasp. I particularly recommend the one with Mae Whitman, which I enjoyed immensely, but they're all quite wonderful. And you can follow Sam on social media. Just follow him on Twitter. He's quite fun to follow, JSamPancake, and you can follow him there and link up to all these other fun things that he is doing. Sam, I will say that The Gilmore Girls was a big deal for me, and to just see us represented on there in this really beautiful way, in this fun way. But I've been following you for so long, and I love that you just keep working and you're putting yourself out there and you're so authentic. It's great to see, Sam.
Thank you again so much. I want to tell Lauren and Amy that you and Dan, you said that. They'll be happy to hear that about Gilmore Girls.
Good stuff. Sam Pancake, please keep doing what you're doing, sir.
Okay, I will.
There she goes again, racing through my
All right, folks, and we are back with another amazing guest on this week's jam-packed episode. Let me introduce her to you. I.W. Gregorio is a practicing surgeon by day, and I am stealing this from her website, and a masked avenging young adult writer by night. Her debut novel is entitled None of the Above. It has reaped in the accolades and recognition, including being named a finalist for the 2016 Lambda Literary Awards, a Spring 2015 Publishers Weekly Flying Start, an ALA Booklist Top 10 Sports Book for Youth, and a 2015 ABC Children's Group Best Book for Young Readers. It was also named to the 2016 American Library Association Rainbow List, and it's under development as a TV series by Lifetime. She is a founding member of We Need Diverse Books, and we're going to talk all about that group, and her writing has appeared in the Washington Post, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Jose Mercury News, and the Journal of General Internal Medicine. Right this very second, she is here with us. Eileen, welcome to The Show Is So Gay.
Thank you so much. This is an honor.
We have so much ground to cover. Are you ready?
Yes. Oh, there's so much ground.
Can I just say that any bio that shouts out that, you know, in your spare time you're a surgeon, that's entertaining.
That's, yes, it is. And people often ask how a urologist became a writer. And I think that the better thing to ask is just how a writer became a urologist, because really I just did it to finance my writing career. So.
Okay. There we go. Because some people take up quilting or crocheting, and you're like, you know what? I'm going to do my MD.
I have to admit it's hereditary. You know, I come from a long family of doctors, and so in many respects it was a path of least resistance. But at the same time, it was also an experience that really opened my eyes into this whole world of economic repercussions and, of course, societal and biologic repercussions. And it really reinforced in me the whole reason I wrote this book, which is to show that, you know, the gender binary is actually a spectrum, not a black or white thing.
Yeah. What was that one pivotal moment? I have to ask. I love hearing about that one pivotal moment when you knew, oh, okay, this practicing surgeon thing, this is totally the career for me.
What made me want to be a surgeon? Well, I have always preferred using my hands to using my brain, which sounds like not a good thing for a doctor, but in reality, there's something amazing about being able to fix things, you know, to be able to literally like use your fingers to touch someone's aorta, to solve a problem, to know that because of what you did physically, you saved someone and you made their pain go away. And, you know, I think that's something that you learn pretty early on in medical school, which is a lot of sitting down and talking and thinking and, you know, talking about maybe this will work, we'll give this medicine and wait 3 months. You know, there's a lot of delayed gratification in medicine, and in many respects, most surgeons like end up doing what they do because they're impatient. They like to get results. But at the same time, what's so fascinating about surgery is that this impatience is also people's downfall. This need to fix things is something that's inherently problematic, because there are a lot of things that we do as doctors that we do because that's the way things have been done
right here.
And I think that that's the way things tie into intersects, and that's one of the things that internal conflict within so many doctors that made me want to write this book.
Yeah.
Because I became very acutely aware of how what I was taught was causing irreparable harm to so many people, and how so many seemingly emergent surgeries in that when I was in residency, ambiguous genitalia, which is sort of a really awful term to describe people whose sex organs just aren't completely, you know, what people are used to, how that's considered a surgical emergency, when in fact it's completely elective. Like, there's nothing life-threatening about most intersects, although there is, you know, one type of intersex that is somewhat life-threatening because it can result in a hormonal problem that can cause death. But most of them, 99% of them, are purely elective, yet they're treated as social emergencies, as psychological emergencies, just because of the anxiety that so many parents feel when their kids don't neatly fit into that checkbox of male or female.
Right. Oh, man, it's just so important that we get these definitions out there. For our listeners who don't know, intersex, a biological condition in which a person is born with sex organs that don't fit neatly into our understanding of what is male or female. You know, I was looking back, I think in 403 episodes, I'm not joking you, Eileen, I don't think that we've talked about intersex identity once, which isn't that part of the issue right there?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's why I'm so you know, honored to be the person discussing intersex, because I'm not intersex myself, and I'm very acutely aware that, you know, in that respect, I'm a poor voice. But at the same time, what my intersex friends have told me is that it's important for the community to know that some of their doctors are standing up for them, and that the important thing is to unveil intersex, because there's so much shame and secrecy surrounding it. Because a lot of doctors don't even understand what intersex is. I mean, when I told some of my medical school friends that I was writing a story about intersex main character, they're like, oh, that's so open-minded of you to write about transgenderism. And I'm like, what are you talking about? You went to medical school. And so that just shows the depth to which, like, how high a mountain we need to climb when it comes to intersex awareness.
There's so much work to do. It gets a little bit overwhelming. Well, let's talk about, you were doing your residency at Stanford. You met a patient who inspired you. Talk about that journey.
Yeah. So I was a senior resident, and as you know, working 70, 80 hours a week. The first patient I treated was someone who was worked up by an older doctor, you know, someone who, you know, had been around for 30, you know, but had gone through medical school like 30 years before. And so he had booked this case for a girl who was 17, had never gotten her period. And so they discovered she had hernias, and inside those hernias were testicles. And that's sort of the classic presentation of something called CAIS, or complete androgen sensitive syndrome, which is a form of intersex where someone looks like a girl, like, throughout her life, externally. Externally, she's phenotypically a girl. She has boobs, you know, she has a vagina, although it's shortened. But internally, she has no uterus, no testes, and her chromosomes are XY. And the boards, so I knew about CAIS from medical school, because in the literally 10 minutes that we spent in that curriculum talking about intersex, we learned that if someone's born with, you know, in bilateral hernias and not getting periods, that's what the answer is. So I knew about this because it was a test question. But I'd never met an intersex patient. No one had ever really talked to me about how to treat an intersex patient except to take these gonads out, which in the past was performed because those gonads, the internal testicles, were thought to be potentially cancerous. Nowadays, we know that the rate of cancer in those gonads is only 1 to 2%, which is less than the lifetime risk of breast cancer, and we don't go lopping off people's breasts.
Right.
And so, but the problem is that all the people who were taught that they need to come out are still practicing, and there hasn't necessarily been any huge outreach to stop these surgeries. And so, you know, I did this surgery, and later on, as I read more and more about intersex, because I was so curious about this patient, I realized, we probably didn't need to do that. Or certainly, we should have talked to her about it more. Because when you do that gonadectomy, when you remove the testicles, you basically condemn that girl to a lifetime of hormonal therapy. You're making her menopausal by taking away her source of hormones. She had no idea.
Wow.
And so a week later, she came into my post-op clinic, and it was a resident clinic in a county hospital, meaning I was alone. I didn't have any oversight. And she was alone, too, because she was uninsured. Her family members probably couldn't take time from work to be with her. And I panicked. You know, literally, this is me being a resident and having to Google how to treat my patient because I hadn't been prepared for how to treat intersex people. And I feel lucky that today the first thing I did was give her information in the support group to show that she was not alone, to show that, you know, even though this is a really rare diagnosis, there are hundreds, thousands of people out there who live wonderful lives and who now have banded together to really try to show that so many of the surgical interventions they were subjected to when they were kids weren't really necessary or could have been delayed. In her case, I did have to talk to her about using hormones because I don't think that anyone had really prepared her for that. And I had to talk to her about the other things, you know, the fact that she couldn't have children, that she might need to have something called dilation of her vagina, which is a non-invasive way to lengthen the vagina to allow for penetrative sex, which, of course, is what all doctors assume is going to, they're going to, their patients are going to have because there's this heteronormative standard, you know, that, you know, vaginas were made to put penises in. When in fact, you know, the rate of lesbianism is the same in those fields as necessary. And so I know some queer intersex patients who went through vaginoplasties for something that they would never need.
Wow.
You know, and as a result, they live with, like, a lifetime of pain. Like, sometimes they damage, they cause, you know, discharge. Like, there are just these countless stories of people whose lives have been irreparably damaged by procedures that were performed on them when they were kids before they really had a time to consent. And you know, that's one of the things that I have to live with, knowing that I did this gonadectomy that, you know, might not have been necessary. And obviously that's what has spurred me into, you know, several years now of activism and wanting to get this story out, wanting to have not only doctors but parents be aware that sometimes the best decision they can make is to not do any harm, is to leave their kids with an open door so that they can choose to be whoever they want to be.
And then magically, and I feel it happened in about an hour and a half, you wrote a book.
Exactly.
I want to talk a little bit about the publishing process. You know, I would like to believe, Eileen, that when people write something that they believe in, then it just happens that everybody picks it up. And it turns out there's this whole publishing process, which includes, as you rightly say, a dark night of the soul. In fact, in some cases, maybe several of them. Talk to me about your journey of getting this into people's hands.
Yeah, well, obviously, the first thing you do is just write.
Yeah.
And the second thing you do is to have people that you trust tell you when it really sucks.
Yeah.
And how to fix it. And then the next part of it is just getting your work out there. And obviously, querying agents and going to conferences actually helped me a lot because I got some great feedback from agents and editors. And in fact, I had one of those fairy tale conference stories that you shouldn't really tell because then everybody gets their hopes up when they go to a conference.
Great.
But my agent actually read part of my manuscript at a conference and asked me for more of it and then offered me representation within 2 hours, which is like really amazing because
wow.
I was so afraid at that point that intersex was something that no one would want to touch because there's so much misunderstanding about it. And luckily, I feel lucky that Jeffrey Eugenides wrote Middlesex because that was an easy comp title. You know, it was basically pitched as Middlesex meets Mean Girls. You know, and that's a hook that I think got a lot of people interested.
Sure.
And so we were decently lucky and after I finished it in that, you know, I got an offer within a month from a really, really respected editor who has actually published a lot of gay YA, including The Miseducation of Cameron Post. By
yeah.
You know, I don't know if you've read
Absolutely.
That. Absolutely. Amazing book. And so... I got lucky that I found an editor and agent who were really passionate about publishing books that weren't just about making money, but were about telling a story that needed to be told at a time that it needs to be told. Interestingly, the path after that was probably the hardest for me, in that I think that the pitfall for a lot of books that are quote issue books is that they are pigeonholed.
Right.
You know, as a result, don't quite have as much marketing, and booksellers don't necessarily know how to sell them quite as well.
Right.
And that has been the big thing for me, is learning how to pitch the book, knowing that for some people, number one, they won't know what intersex is, and so there's that educational standpoint, and number two, so many people will confuse it with transgender and either really embrace it or push it as far away as possible. And that has been the most interesting dance to dance. So how I've talked about the book is that I've just talked about how my comp title that I actually like to use is actually to compare the book to the middle grade book Wonder, which is a story about a kid with a craniofacial abnormality that he was born with, that was maybe one of the first books to really bring that subject to children's literature.
Okay.
And what I tell people is that this is just a book about how there is no normal and how the girl next door could be intersex and you wouldn't even know it. And what's interesting about the book is that Kristen gets her diagnosis when she's 17 or she's 18, and so she's a fully formed person. And she's the same exact person the day after she finds out her diagnosis that she was the day before. And yet her whole world has changed. And so I talk a lot about what it means to be a woman and about whether your chromosomes really determine who you love and who they love you. And just about how, when you say normal, when you say you want to be especially normal, what you're saying to a lot of people is just that you want to be average.
Right.
And the exceptional is really out there so that you can find the people who are your true friends, who love the you, rather than the you that you present to the world or that they perceive you as. And that's sort of been the way that I've been trying to pitch it as specifically a book for teens, because it really has, I think, opened a lot of eyes. And, you know, some people will pick it up and put it down because they perceive that they won't mean anything to them. But because I think a lot of people go into bookstores just wanting to see mirrors of themselves. But in the diversity world, we like to talk about how books are windows more than mirrors.
Yeah.
And in that respect, that's how I pitch the book, is this window into something that you've never seen before. So just try a different view.
Such good stuff. Again, listeners, we are here with I.W. Gregorio, author of None of the Above in Her Spare Time, Possibly a Surgeon. Talk to me about some of the feedback that you received. I feel like you definitely have been stopped in your tracks by people contacting you and saying thank you for this, because I've seen it online.
Yeah. No. There are two types of people. There are obviously the people who are intersex and who are like, thank you for telling our story in a respectful way, and thank you for, you know, giving me my favorite one from an intersex girl is from a 13-year-old girl who had known she's intersex for a while, but didn't actually approach the support group until after she read the book.
Wow.
And I actually met her this summer at the support group meeting, and she, like, got up in front of, like, this group of hundreds of people to tell her story. It was this, a spiritual event where I was like, wow. I could have sold one book, and it would have been, you know, worth everything.
Yeah.
And the other part of it, too, is the people who had no idea what it was and who White Intersex was and whose minds were completely blown. So there's that window aspect of it. You know, there's a woman I met in California who said that one of her sisters was a teacher, and she showed it to her teens. And, you know, the best feedback any writer can possibly have is that we couldn't put this book down and, you know, read it in a day. And that's definitely the most amazing stuff, to know that people in, you know, rural Tennessee, or, you know, in places where their teachers probably, I'm actually surprised that their teachers had the books on their shelves, or were allowed to have the books on their shelves, read it, and, you know, it opened their eyes to the point where, you know, they might be different human beings than they were.
Right.
A little while ago. And I think one of the most touching pieces of feedback that I've ever gotten was actually from a woman who had formerly dated an intersex woman, you know, 10 years ago, talking about how that relationship kind of dissolved because of so much of the self-hatred that her partner felt because of her intersex diagnosis, and wishing that she had been able to read my book when she was a teenager.
Wow.
And that's the thing, just to realize how many people are touched not only by your book, but by your readers, really.
Incredible. Incredible stuff. Finally, you have to tell our listeners, why do we need diverse books?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, go to weneeddiversebooks.org, and then there will be lots of pictures of why. But we need diverse books because books are humanity's best tool to create empathy and compassion in a world that very desperately needs it. We need diverse books because I want my child to be someone who welcomes people with differences from her with open arms. We need diverse books because Black Lives Matter, because the Muslim ban is unacceptable.
Right.
Because your chromosome shouldn't determine who you love and who loves you, because there's too much hate out there for us to go through life not being aware of how many different ways there are to love.
There it is. There it is. All right, listeners, this is what we need you to go do. Stroll on over to iwgregorio.com, iwgregorio.com, and you can learn all about Irene and the incredible work that she is doing. You must pick up a copy of None of the Above. Learn more about intersex identity. I love that that's a tab right there. She's got events. She's got press. So many things happening. I have to tell you this. You are doing exactly what we want everybody to be doing, is using your voice in your own unique way to make a difference. And it is so valued. And I love just touring around online and seeing the unadulterated appreciation for this work that you put out there and the way that you use your voice to make a difference. It's wonderful to behold.
Well, thank you so much, and for everything that you do to keep on keeping on.
And by the way, during your day job, if you ever need a sub in, I just want to put out there that I've watched all 15 seasons of ER, and I think I can put in a central line. So if you need a hand, I'm here.
Well, but can you do a vasectomy in 5 minutes?
With a pen in a store, yes.
Okay. All right, good. Good.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, not a ton of time left on this week's episode, but let's get to some of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. In a ruling that paves the way for Taiwan to become the first place in Asia to recognize same-sex marriage, the Constitutional Court this week struck down the Civil Code's definition of marriage as being only between a man and a woman. The legislature right there in Taiwan now has 2 years years to either amend the civil code or to enact laws addressing same-sex couples. If the legislature fails to pass an amendment or legislation in the next 2 years, same-sex couples shall be allowed to have their marriage registration effectuated at the authorities in charge of household registration. So that means there was a lot of cheering that broke out among the hundreds of supporters who gathered outside the Taiwanese legislature monitoring developments on a big screen television. This might be the first step to there being same-sex marriage, not just in Taiwan, but it would be the first place in all of Asia to recognize same-sex marriage. So that's a big deal. They have 2 years to figure it out, but this is how progress happens. We like that a lot. Coming back to the U.S. for a story, it was announced this week that the New England Patriots are set to sponsor Gay Bowl 17. I had never even heard of Gay Bowl. I didn't even know that was a thing. It's a national championship tournament for LGBT flag football teams. I had absolutely no idea. The tournament will be held in Boston in October. The event has been held since 2002. Apparently, I've been missing it for quite some time now. And 40 teams are expected to compete this year. According to the Gay Bowl's official website, there will be an Open A, Open B, and Women's divisions at the tournament to be held in Progen Park in Lancaster, Massachusetts. The Boston area last hosted the Gay Bowl in 2003. Love the fact that the Patriots have just become the first NFL team to sponsor the LGBT flag football group's Gay Bowl. That is progress. There's such an active gay sports scene right here in Cleveland. I am loving seeing it. There are so many posts out there. There's dodgeball, there's kickball. They just announced there's going to be bocce ball this summer. I'm trying to get the tennis players back together again. It's another way, if you're looking for a way to bring together the LGBTQ community in your area, start some sort of league. It doesn't take that much effort. I mean, you need some help because it is a little bit of work, but it's a great way to bring people together. So look into doing that, all right? A couple of Texas stories, and yet again, the moral of the story is, really, Texas, this is how you're spending your time? Story number one, the Texas Senate has given final approval to a measure to allow adoption agencies to discriminate against LGBT people. House Bill 3859, also known as the Freedom to Serve Children Act, is similar to legislation passed in other states. It would allow state-funded adoption agencies to discriminate against couples based on religious belief. Oh, man. After passing in the Senate, the bill would go to Governor Greg Abbott for his signature. LGBT groups have strongly opposed the bill. Same-sex couples or trans parents could be refused the right to adopt under the bill. The measure was passed by the Texas House last week with 93 votes to 49 votes. HB 3859 not only allows couples to be turned down for adoption, but it also would allow anti-LGBT counseling, which includes, of course, conversion therapy. A similar measure was proposed back in 2016. If it passes, the bill would allow child welfare service providers that contract with the state to use taxpayer money to discriminate against LGBT individuals and their families. That is from the ACLU of Texas. That's what they're saying about the bill. The ACLU of Texas's executive director, Terry Burke, said this, quote, "It's about as limiting a bill as we have seen." Burke added that this bill becoming law would mean that if you say you have a sincerely held religious belief and you are a private adoption agency or private entity that helps place foster children, you can say you will not place that child with gay parents. And if you're thinking, all right, that's what they're spending time on in Texas, surely they're focusing on other things. No, apparently they're not. They're doing some other really nutty things as well. The Senate in Texas, they have revived a full bathroom bill, which would require trans people to only use public bathrooms which correspond to their sex at birth. At 1 a.m. on Wednesday, this is what they were doing at 1 a.m. on Wednesday, the Senate voted 21-10 to attach an amendment to an unrelated bill about county governments. 1 a.m., they are attaching this as an amendment to a bill about county governments. The Democrat who put forward the bill, which the amendment was attached to, won't accept the changes. A full bill, which would have had the same effect, passed in the Senate in March, but was stalled in the Texas House. This is what they are spending time on. On Sunday, a bill passed by the House would apply the same rules, but only to school students. This is what, I know, I'm just saying it over and over again. This is what they are spending time on there in the state of Texas. Let's look at some of our national leaders. Donald Trump's Housing and Urban Development Secretary, Dr. Ben Carson, well, he is reportedly speaking to a global conference of anti-LGBT activists in Hungary. Dr. Carson, who is a longtime opponent of LGBT rights, is reportedly set to attend the World Congress of Families event in Hungary later this week. The annual event is attended by anti-gay activists from around the world, and a press release for this year pledges the, quote, launch of a new global pro-family alliance of countries dedicated to defending marriage and the family. The Southern Poverty Law Center reports that Dr. Carson will be speaking at the event, though the topic of his talk is not listed. I can't wait to find out, you know, what the big topic is. At last year's event in Moscow, delegates to this conference backed the rollout of Russia-style gay propaganda laws, and this is what Dr. Ben Carson is going to be flying on taxpayer money to go attend. Great, great, great. Congress agreed on a $1.1 trillion omnibus spending bill that will fund most federal government operations through fiscal year 2017, which ends September 30th. The bill's funding levels for health agencies and programs stand in sharp contrast to the Trump administration budget blueprint for fiscal year 2018, which was released this week. The National Institutes of Health will get a $2 billion funding increase for the remainder of fiscal year 2017. And why this is all really good is that many who are pouring through this budget are saying that money will indeed be going to LGBT people and to people living with HIV and AIDS. Very good stuff there, though we'll see what happens with the proposed budget, which, you know, pretty much cuts everything. A few U.S. senators have written a letter to outgoing U.S. Census Bureau Director John Thompson asking him to explain why questions regarding LGBT identity will not be part of the upcoming census. They wrote this, quote, "As you have stated in the past, complete census data is critical to meet a wide range of federal needs, from providing apportionment and redistricting data as part of our representative democracy to helping distribute more than $400 billion in federal funds annually. This is why it is critical that the Census Bureau's process to include subjects to fairly and accurately count all Americans is impartial and free from undue influence." The Census Bureau released a report, just to remind you all, in March, stating that its 2020 census plans would not include questions about sexual identity and gender orientation. So, yeah, there won't be any data that reflects where gay people are in the country. And it's not just about visibility. I talked about this on an episode maybe a few months back when this report initially came out. It's not just about visibility, though visibility is really important. The census data, demography, that's how we decide where money goes. So if we are not counting gay people, if we are not counting LGBTQ people, we don't know how to distribute the money. We can't create programming that's appropriate to the communities and who lives there. So this is a really critical issue, and I know it's not super sexy, and I know we're talking about the census, but it is so important that we ask questions about sexual orientation and gender identity. So contact your local representative and urge them to do so. This is how money gets given out. It's super, super important. And that is my urging for you on this week's episode. And hey, if I can push you to another thing, go to Amazon. Go pick up my book. It is available right this very second. Pre-order is over. Now you can order your book on Amazon and it will come straight away. The name of the book is Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wondering and Wandering Gay Jew. That's me. Seriously, What Am I Doing Here? The Adventures of a Wandering and Wandering Gay Jew. Strolling over to Amazon. It is available right this very second. Go pick it up. Get out there. Go use your voice, my friends, the way you know how to use it to make a difference for your LGBTQ brothers and sisters, for all of our allies out there. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?